Susan, all right.
Are we ready to start again, Linda?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're on page 2-15. I put in the booklet a couple of examples of the challenges we do face in compliance, seeking voluntary compliance with taxpayers. 2-16 is a little article that came out of the Sunday Oregonian and really points out a trend that we find quite disturbing. We talked about the importance of the withholding system to get state revenues in easily for employees and the state as well. And there is a movement out there right now where some employers are saying that they don't have to pay taxes, and neither do their employees. And we've actually got calls from employers who've heard about this and want to find out if this is true, as well as their employees. So this is kind of an example of the things we really need to work to stem. The page 2-17 is another example of that, and this Lynn Meredith is a fairly well-known individual who's been holding seminars in various parts of the nation, including Oregon, promoting the concept that you do not have to pay taxes. You can actually stop your employer from withholding. You can set up trusts that will eliminate your need to pay taxes. And she's got a little following. Our Medford office was dealing with some issues that people believed in what she was promoting, and they've resolved that with the taxpayers. But it's very very cumbersome. It's very time-consuming for both the taxpayer and the state to unravel this if someone goes down these paths. So this is a worrisome tax we've seen moving. 2-19, I wanted to close this part about the education assistance and enforcement and just focus on the employee piece of it, because basically what the Department of Revenue has are our employees and the technology we use to support them. 2-19 is the code of conduct that our employees developed back, I think it was in 97. We, in light of the issues that the IRS was facing, we really wanted to talk about how are we evaluating our staff's performance. It's much more than dollars collected or cases closed. It's really how we treat the taxpayers, our communities, and each other. So the employees took it on themselves and went out and talked to their coworkers that everyone acknowledges does the very best job. So this is kind of a development of a best practices concept. And they came back and capsulized what these people are doing and reiterated our values and our mission up here, our business's compliance piece, but then talked about the guiding principle to work with people in a courteous and respectful manner to help them understand the voluntary comply, and then the personal qualities and best practices that our most successful employees use. So we actually use this. It's posted in different parts of the agency, and this is used as we evaluate people's performance on how well they're doing their job. So it's been an effective way to kind of bring our attention back that the key focus on this really is the taxpayer and what we can do to serve him or her. And with that, I'd like to move into the final piece, which is a discussion of the policy option packages. I believe Sue mentioned to you that we did receive a policy option package last biennium, and on 2-20, we are just summarized the positions we received, the FTE, the cost, and then the revenue we committed to raise. And we've actually exceeded our goal. The goal of revenue generation was $15,851,000, roughly. And at this point in the biennium, we've collected through December of 2000 about $20 million. So we have exceeded our goal. So we're happy to report that back. I wish Representative Butler was here because he was very concerned whether we could meet our goal, but we have. And on 2-21, these are the policy option packages that are proposed for in the governor's recommended budget and also the revised budget that Monica alluded to. The recommended budget, we're providing resources to improve enforcement, education, and assistance, and including the infrastructure and support positions we need to do that as well. We're looking at not only increasing short-term revenue, but increasing assistance to individuals and businesses, and really looking at long-term revenue growth and long-term voluntary compliance. It has 39 positions, 37 FTE, at a cost of $3.9 million. General fund. I would like to point out a correction on this page. We had originally said that we expect to raise an $18.5 million based on the revenue we've been bringing in. We've exceeded our revenue goal for the past package, so we felt comfortable increasing the revenue from 18.5, this is about two-thirds of the way down the page, to $20 million general fund. And so the net revenue we would generate from this is 16.1. So we're about, we upped it by $1.5 billion based, we feel comfortable on that based on our experience. So that's what's in the recommended budget that you have in your book. The second piece is the revised budget, and this would add $1.6 million to the general fund with 16 positions, 14.6 FTE, and this really focuses more on filing enforcement for the personal income tax program and increased audits within the corporate income and excise tax program. We expect to generate $7.9 million in general fund, and that would net the state $6.3 million general fund.
Now, these are two separate packages. They are both for tax collection activities, but there's two different components to it here.
Mr. Chair, yes. The initial component is actually in your big book. The governor's recommended actually has that. The second component was the governor's piece to rebalance the budget. It builds upon the first package, really, and it would have an education assistance component in it, but it really is targeted more at filing enforcement and more of the, we bring in more of the corporate income tax program in the second smaller package as well. So it, okay.
So the total FTE would be 39 plus 16.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. 39 plus the 16 positions.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And with that, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. If not, we will proceed on with discussion with the Information Processing Division.
Well, I'll pull the other committee members.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Now I'd like to ask Jack Ogani, who is the administrator of our Information Processing Division, to come up and talk to you about automation and technology.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jack Ogami. For the record, I'm the administrator of the Information Processing Division, and this morning I'd like to provide some information on the ways we're using technology to process the 1.7 million personal income tax returns we receive every year, and also the ways we're using technology to bank the $6.6 billion that we receive every year, and finally, the ways we're using technology to provide automated taxpayer assistance. Now, if you'll turn to page 2-26, we have a chart that shows the dramatic change in the way Oregonians are preparing and filing their income tax returns. The dark blue area on this chart reflects manually prepared paper returns. And as you saw yesterday on our tour, those manually prepared paper returns cost us $1.29 each to process through our center. The yellow and light green areas of the chart represent returns that have been prepared using tax preparation software. This software generally provides two options for the taxpayer. The first option, which is chosen by about 663,000 taxpayers, is to print a paper return. This paper return is key punch friendly, and because it is key punch friendly, we can process it through our center for only 77 cents. The other option that's available for a user of tax preparation software is to file the return electronically. An electronically filed return is paperless and costs us 20 cents to push through our processing center. Naturally, one of our agency strategies is to promote electronic filing so we can take full advantage of the cost advantages that are associated with electronic filing.
Is the preponderance of people that use either the electronic filing or the computer-generated paper returns professional tax preparers or individual?
The majority of professional tax preparers.
Okay.
Now, if you turn to page 2-30, I'd like to get into how we're processing the $6.6 billion that we receive every year. We have two charts there. The top chart, titled Dollars Received, there's the yellow area that represents the $3 billion we receive every year in electronic funds transfer. And electronic funds transfer represents a transfer directly from the taxpayer's bank into the state's treasury. This represents 45% of the dollars we receive. Now, if you look at the bottom chart, which represents the number of payment transactions we receive, electronic funds transfer represents only 10% of the transactions. So it means that taxpayers are still sending us 3 million paper checks that we need to process through our center in a timely and efficient manner. Luckily, we found a technology solution for this in the form of our high-speed remittance processing machine that you got to see yesterday. And with that high-speed remittance processor, we're able to process the majority of the checks we receive in one banking day.
So this means that the big spenders are filing electronically and mom and pop are filing?
Paying electronically.
Paying electronically.
Yes, sir.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And that's why you're getting $3 billion electronically from a small number of returns. Okay.
And this is an example of one of the ways that technology has been helping us to meet the demands of the paper system and yet take advantage of the electronic systems that are out there.
Why would they want to do that? Why wouldn't they want the 4 or 5 days float if these are big dollars?
Well, in 1997 or 96, the legislature passed a law that required employers and corporations to pay their large employers and corporations to pay their payments to us electronically versus by check. So these are primarily the largest payments that we would ordinarily receive.
So you might not have such large utilization if it weren't required statutorily?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Because they're giving up 4 or 5 days interest?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now on page 2-32, we have a chart that shows the 624,000 instances where taxpayers have taken advantage of our automated taxpayer assistance systems. And the dark blue area, which represents our telephone-based individual voice response system, which we also call the IVR, there were 367 instances where taxpayers called into our individual voice response system and listened to a pre-recorded message concerning some tax topic, or inquired on the status of their return or refund, because there is an interactive component to this telephone-based system. The other feature of this telephone system is that at any point in time during normal business hours, the taxpayer can zero out and get a live attendant to answer any specific questions they might have.
What's the waiting? Excuse me, Madam Chair. I'm still chairman here.
That's fine. Go ahead.
What's the waiting time on the telephone?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I believe the waiting time varies off season versus on season. I don't know the specific numbers, but I can get those. I can get those for you. Okay. The chart also shows the 257,000 times taxpayers have accessed our web-based web page. And we understand that taxpayers really enjoy the convenience of the downloadable tax forms, all the instructions, as well as the links to other tax-based websites that we have there. And this pretty much concludes my report on how we're using technology to process income tax returns, how we're using technology to efficiently bank the payments that we receive at the department, and also how we're using technology to provide automated taxpayer assistance. So I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have related to this.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that probably we won't all be here in 100 years, but as history looks back upon us, we'll see this technology era we're in as probably as great as what the Industrial Revolution was. I think it's just marvelous when you stop and think about the things that have happened just in the last 10 years with technology, and the fact that you're current with that and helping taxpayers make it easier for us to be able to work with you is wonderful. Any questions? Not? Okay, we'll go ahead with the next portion. Thank you,
Madam Chair. I could perhaps address Representative Hayden's question a little bit.
Okay.
During the filing season, when a lot of people are trying to call, the wait times do get longer, and we're not able to answer all of the calls. So I know that we have a system that tracks how long people are waiting, and a system that serves up the telephone calls to whoever of our public service representatives who are not on the phone at the time. But I know the wait times get to be fairly long, and longer than 4 minutes, and some people will just give up and not wait. And so we're trying very hard to provide as much information through the interactive voice response as we can, so that if their question can be answered that way, they have that option instead of trying to wait for a human being to answer their call.
Okay, well, we're ready to go into the shift gears now and go into the property tax system. And Randy Evers, who is the administrator of the property tax division, is going to come up and speak to you about that.
Good morning, Randy, and if you'll state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Evers, and I'm the administrator of the property tax division. We are going to shift gears away from income tax to property tax. 23 years ago, I started at the Department of Revenue, and for my first 20 years, worked in the income tax and corporate excise tax programs. And 3 years ago, when I shared with my family and friends that I was moving to property tax, they were all kind of taken aback, because a lot of people don't think of the state of Oregon and the property tax system, but we do provide a supervision to a statewide property tax system that's administered at the local level. We take a lot of pride and a lot of passion in working with the counties, the assessors, and the collectors, and having an effective statewide property tax system. This morning, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how the property tax system works today. I'll try not to get into too much detail, but I think it's important to have kind of a basic understanding of how the system works today. And then talk to you a little bit about the revenues and the expenditure side. I'd like to share with you a little bit about a policy option package that the governor has included in his recommended budget, and then a little bit about productivity and innovations at the end of my presentation. And I think we can probably do this in about 20 minutes.
Sounds great.
If you will please turn to page 3-2, I'd like to give you a fairly high-level overview of Oregon's property tax history for the last 10 years. We had two major measures that passed in the 90s. Measure 5 passed in 1990, and then Measure 47, which was rewritten into Measure 50, was passed in 1997. I'd like to go back for just a minute to pre-Measure 5 days and give you just the basics of how the property tax system worked. In those days, the taxing districts would calculate the amount of revenues they needed to provide the services for the citizens in their taxing districts. The assessor would have the value of all the properties in that taxing district. Rates were calculated, and then when the rates were applied against the value, that would generate the amount of revenues that those districts needed in order to perform the services. What was happening in the mid and late 80s was that the rates were getting very high. Some of you might remember rates in the area of $30 per thousand. And so the citizens were concerned about that. Measure 5 was passed in 1990, and over a period of about 5 years, the rates were brought down so that the limit was $5 per thousand for education, and then $10 per thousand for general government, which would include the special districts and the cities and the counties. The anticipation of citizens at that time was that they would see significant property tax reductions, or at least a leveling of the property taxes statewide. And if you remember, in the mid to early to mid 90s, we saw a significant increase in the value of properties. So while the rates are starting to come down, the values of the properties are going up rather dramatically, and citizens didn't see the kind of relief that they were expecting. Thus, Measure 47 was passed by the citizens and rewritten by the legislature in 1997. And what Measure 50 does, it also provides some relief to the value growth for properties. The assessor, I think one of the misperceptions about Measure 50 was that the system would be easier today. There was misperception that there would be just 3% growth and that's all that we would have to track. But what the assessor is required to do today is to actually track three values for every piece of property. They're required to continue to track the real market value, which is the value that a home or a piece of property would sell in the marketplace between a willing seller and a willing buyer. They're required to keep a Measure 50 limit. What Measure 50 said, let's go back to the 95 value, reduce it by 10%, establish a base, and that Measure 50 base can only grow at 3% a year. So they have to track the real market value, the Measure 50 limit, and the lower of those two numbers becomes the assessed value, or the value that you pay tax on. So I hope I didn't bore you with a lot of detail, but I think it's important to understand a little bit about the property tax system today and the some of the difficulties in administering it at the county level.
Senator Dukes, don't they still have to track the Measure 5 limit as well?
Yes, they do. And a little later I'll talk about that, but for purposes of calculating the limits on the rates, they still use the real market value for something called compression, which I won't bore you with the details, but it is important to track real market value as well. And I'll give you a couple examples of why that's important in just a few minutes.
I have one other question from this page. Under Measure 50, where it says the limit calculation is based on the value growth of 3% per year plus new additions. Do you have a sheet or anything on the new additions piece?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't with me, but I'd be happy to get that for you.
I appreciate that. I had this esoteric discussion with an appraiser one day when I was in the assessor's office, and I don't know why we were there, but we were there. And I served on the committee that wrote the stuff. And now, it's been a few years, but my memory of what we were doing and her belief in practice of what we were doing were different, and I wanted to kind of review it and see.
I'd be happy to provide that information to you. The third bullet under Measure 50 that occurred then were that tax rates are now permanently fixed, so there's no ability for taxing districts to increase those rates, and they're permanent under Measure 50. If you will please turn to page 3-3. Very briefly, I talked a little bit about a statewide partnership between the state of Oregon and the counties on policy direction. We do work very closely with the assessors and the tax collectors on developing both legislative proposals and writing administrative rules to clarify legislation. We develop a variety of manuals and we establish statewide guidelines to assist the counties. Some examples of that would be publications that we put together to help them appraise industrial properties that are under $1 million. In a little bit, I'll explain to you that the state actually does the appraisal for those values that are over $1 million. We partner individually with assessors on difficult issues. Recently, we had 8 new assessors from throughout the state come in. We provided training to them. It's not uncommon that if a new assessor needs assistance. For instance, last year in Wallowa County, we had a brand new assessor, and it was our first time in turning a tax roll. So our field staff actually went to their office and helped them understand how to turn the tax roll and get property tax statements out. In some counties that are small, very candidly, they may not have the expertise to appraise a very difficult property, a golf or resort type property. And so we will go out and provide training and assist them in doing an appraisal of a rather complex property. And the last bullet I'd like to talk about, and it's been raised earlier a little bit about the grant funds that go from the state to the counties. Back in the late 80s, there was a report that came out called the Deterioration of the Property Tax System, and Senator Dukes commented on this, I believe, yesterday. There was a 6-year cycle that counties were to appraise property on. Very candidly, the counties were having difficulty keeping up with that 6-year cycle. The state created a grant fund that was first available for the 1990-91 fiscal year. In the first year, the grant funds available to the counties were about $11.7 million to help assist the counties. In the last year, that has grown to a little over $20 million that is available to assist the counties with doing their assessment taxation work county by county. Just a little bit about the process. The county puts together a grant proposal by May 1st, submits it to the Department of Revenue. By that time, our field staff has done a lot of work with the counties on what is needed in each county to continue to have a successful assessment taxation program. By June 15th, the department then takes in all those 36 grants, and as long as the department is comfortable that they can continue to have an effective assessment taxation program, we calculate a percentage of how they will share in those grant funds, and then on a quarterly basis throughout the fiscal year, return those monies to the counties. And one of the questions that came up yesterday was about the $5 million that was set aside last biennium. We have returned all of that money except for $625,000, which will be going out on April the 13th. So all of the $5 million will end up in the 36 counties throughout the state. Turning to page 3-4, the latest data we have with regard to property tax revenues is for 99-2000 fiscal year. $2.8 billion was the amount of property tax revenues generated in the system, and this shows the breakdown starting to the right. From that amount, about $1.23 billion goes to schools, K-12, ESDs, and community colleges. The city's share in about $626 million of that revenue. The counties receive $537 million. The special districts, which include things like road districts, fire districts, water districts, cemetery districts, receive $297 million, and about $109 million goes to urban renewal in urban renewal areas throughout the state. So that's how the revenue is spent. On page 3-5, this shows the expenditure side of the system on an annual basis, about $75.8 million. And again, the components of that. The general fund for the counties pays for about $46 million. The county share of the grant funds that I talked about a little bit earlier is about $17.7 million. The department general fund that the legislature provides to us is about $9.5 million. The department can also share in the grant monies. The department under statute can take our actual expenses up to 10% of the fund, and that's reflected in the $1.8 million. And then the department has about $0.8 million of other funds for property tax purposes. Pages 3-6 and 3-7. Are primarily a breakdown. 3-6 is the department's expenditures, which are about $12.1 million per year. And 3-7 is the county's share of the breakdown, which is the $63.7 million per year. So I won't bore you with any details unless you have questions about that. It just provides a breakdown for the state and the county and some of the functions that the counties perform. I would make one comment on 3-7. You'll see that the county spend about $9.4 million for data processing. It's the yellow piece that sticks out. Mr. Mineri referred to this earlier this morning, but when Measure 50 passed, there was a tremendous amount of reprogramming that needed to be done in order to track the three values for all properties. For some properties, such as farmland, they track five values because there's also an especially assessed component for farmland. So the reprogram in the counties was a fairly extensive effort, and you'll see that reflected in the $9.4 million that's spent for data processing throughout the state. I'd like to talk about just a couple of the major functions that the department provides in the property tax system. The first one begins on 3-8. Yesterday, some of you, Madam Chair, didn't get to see our cartography unit. But we did walk folks through our mapping area. We provide general mapping support to all 36 counties in the state by providing mapping standards and assistance on an as-needed basis. For 15 counties, we actually are the cartographer for the county. We do the day-to-day mapping work for those counties on a 50-50 share. The state pays 50 cents of each dollar, and the county pays 50 cents. This last morning, we're happy to announce we added two new counties, Malheur County, which I know Representative Butler would be happy about, and Union Counties were two counties that we picked up as maintenance counties. On the page 3-9 is a graphic that shows the different counties throughout the state. The bluish-green are three of the counties, Clatsop, Tillamook, and Lincoln, where we are actually doing a conversion project to move them from paper or individual computerized maps to a seamless digital map throughout the county, and we do that on a 50-50 cost share. The yellow counties are the counties where we are the cartographer and do their maintenance mapping. The light orange counties are those that we, in addition to the maintenance mapping on a day-to-day basis, we're also in the process of converting those two counties to digital, which is Hood River and Grant. And then the purple counties, and typically because of the size and the amount of work, have their own cartography staffs, and then the department just provides general supervision and assistance. On page 3-10, another fairly significant component of the property tax system is our assistance and local budget support. I won't go through all the bullets, but one of the most complex things I found in the property tax system is local budget law. It takes a lot of expertise. We have five very talented staff members that travel throughout the state and do an excellent job of providing training. And when they're at their desk, the phones are usually ringing and they're answering questions about local budget law. So they do a very good job, and that's a significant function that we provide to the property tax system. On 3-11, again, briefly, training and appraiser certification is one of the major functions that the department provides. By year, you'll see some of the training that we provide to them. I just wanted to share with you yesterday in a conversation with one of the assessors, as the department is concerned, the counties are concerned about successor planning. Their staffs are very candidly aging, and they are concerned about the amount of turnover that they will have. And so there is a strong concern from the counties for the department to have the ability to train their new appraisal staff. Very candidly, they're looking at the kind of skill sets that they're going to need in the future to attract new candidates. The opportunity to bring people in with a lot of property tax experience may not be there. And we may have to look at different skill sets, people to have good PC skills, have strong work ethics, the ability to want to learn and have a career in the property tax system are some of the things that we'll be looking at in order to attract people to the property tax system throughout the state. And so we do a significant amount of training to assist in that effort. 3-12, I promise this is my last little educational piece, but I did want to share with you the importance of keeping market values in today's property tax system, and this goes to Senator Duke's question. There are three very important reasons why the market value is important to maintain. When Measure 50 was passed, one of the things that the legislature wanted to ensure was that as new property came on the tax roll, it got the same benefits that property received that existed at the time that Measure 50 passed. So if a brand new home is built today, and I'll try to use a fairly simple example, if a brand new home is built today and the real market value is $100,000, and you look at a property that existed before 1997 and its real market value is $100,000, so they're comparable, and the existing property has a maximum assessed value at the Measure 50 limit of 80, then this new property also gets a Measure 50 limit of $80,000. Now, that wasn't done in other states, such as in California when Proposition 13 was passed, and so you have a wide variety of taxable values in the state of California. In the state of Oregon, the legislature considered that. The only way that we can determine that percentage is by keeping accurate market values on all the properties throughout the state. And so there is a misperception that if we just track the 3%, we can get the work done in the property tax system, and there's no way that we could calculate those percentages. It's called a ratio, in the technical term of the change property ratio. And so that's one of the things that the assessor has to do today. It's important. The second one is what Senator Dukes referenced earlier. The market values are still used to provide the Measure 5 relief. That's where the rates were actually applied is to the Measure 5 limits. And the third one, and it leads into the next two pages, for most industrial properties and centrally assessed, the department's responsible for valuing those properties over $1 million in the industrial program and for all centrally assessed properties. For many of those properties, because they actually depreciate in value, their Measure 50 limit is here, but their real market value or their taxable value is under the limit. And so that is the value that the taxes are based on. So it's very important that we have accurate real market values for those types of properties in calculating the taxes. On page 3-13, very briefly, the industrial valuation program, as I mentioned, we value all the properties that are over $1 million in value. Statewide, that is $15.3 billion in real market value and represents about 878 sites. And then for those properties under $1 million that the counties are responsible, we do a significant amount of training to assist them. Pages 3-14 and 3-15 are breakouts that show just a little bit more detail about the industrial program. The map on 3-14 for your interest shows where the sites are actually located, and on a county-by-county basis shows where that $15.3 billion of value is distributed on a county-by-county basis. 3-15 is the page I'd really like to focus on for just a moment or two. The top graph shows the number of sites and the increase from 1989 to the year 2000. You'll see on the red line toward the top of the graph that in 1989 we were responsible for about 690 sites statewide. In our staffing level at the bottom, it's a little difficult to see, but the blue line, we had 30 staff to do that work. In the year 2000, the number of sites has grown to 878, and our staffing levels have increased by 2 to 32. So there's been a fairly significant increase in the number of sites. More dramatically, at the bottom of the page, you'll see that in 1989, the roll value for all the industrial sites were a little less than $5 billion. And in the year 2000, again, with an increase of staff of 2, we are now responsible for over $15 billion of value in industrial. The concern that we have with that, what's becoming difficult, is just the sheer number of the dollars involved in the property tax system. It's kind of a ripe area for appeals of these values. It's not uncommon that we will do a facility that might be in the $200 or $300 million value area. And if in evaluation, just a swing of 10 or 20%, which is not uncommon in appraising properties, we're talking a lot of tax dollars. So just the value increases themselves have created some concerns in keeping accurate values on the roll. Another thing that's very candidly is the use of technology today. If you think about some of the high-tech companies and so forth, we had a facility that was owned in Portland that was almost ready to go into production. It was going to be about a $400 million facility. And when the Asian flu, as they call it, crisis hit and the demand for microprocessing equipment went down dramatically, the company was arguing that that had a value of about $80 million. So we anywhere from $400 to $80 million, somewhere in that range is probably the correct value. But you can just see something that happens to the economy, and then the high-tech area can really have a dramatic impact on the value. So it's a real challenge to us to keep these values on the roll accurately. On page 3-17, the other main thing we do in the valuation area is we appraise all what are called centrally assessed properties. They're primarily in four categories. There are the energy companies, telecommunications, the railroads, and the airlines. And again, on pages 3-18 and 3-19, we provided a similar breakout. The map on 3-18 shows where the accounts are located and the value in each county. And on pages 3-19, again, we show the increase in sites. For these types of properties in 89, we had 336 accounts. In the year 2000, we have 439 accounts, so an increase of a little over 100. Again, at the bottom, the more dramatic change, again, is the value in 1989 of about $6.7 million for centrally assessed. We had a staff of five people working those accounts, and today we have a value of about $12 billion that we send to the counties to put on the tax rolls at the county level, and again, with no staffing increase. So. Very difficult properties worth a lot of money is a challenge to us. On page 3-20 is the as part of the governor's recommended budget is the policy option package that we're asking for. It adds seven positions to the Department of Revenue. That's funded $406,000 by general fund dollars and $514,000 from other funds limitation. Our expectation in adding these positions is that we will bring about $3.88 million in additional property tax revenues to be shared by schools, counties, cities, and special districts. For the sake of time, on 3-21, we've included some productivity gains, increased productivity through innovations. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. And on 3-22, some planned innovations for the future that we have in the property tax system. Jim and Eri talked about ORMAP. We're really excited about the possibilities of ORMAP and what it can do for the property tax system. And with that, I will conclude. I think I've run out of time and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Fine. Well, good morning. Good morning. We are just about to adjourn. They have given us some wonderful information and information about Ontario as well, and you have just returned from there, I
understand.
Yes, everything okay over in Ontario?
It's delightful.
Good. Good. We're happy to have you back.
State tourism is very fine.
Good. We've just finished the last segment of this presentation, and since the Senate starts the Senate floor session in a few minutes, we are about to adjourn. And if you wouldn't mind staying, and Susan Browning, who gave the presentation, if you have a few minutes, maybe we can recap.
I'd be delighted to do
that.
We've
covered some wonderful information today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And tomorrow we will, Sue, we will finish up, let's see,
public hearing.
Public hearing on the portion, Elizabeth, is that correct, on the tobacco tax program?
Yes, Madam Chair, and actually the way we have paced things, we'll have plenty of time for questions tomorrow. So if members have questions about any of the program areas, tomorrow would be a great time to
I know you covered some things from Ontario, and if you wouldn't mind staying a few minutes and visiting with Representative Butler and catching him up, we would appreciate that, and thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow, and we are adjourned. appreciate you hurrying to be back. We did have a good...